This is the G and Ursula Show with G. Scott and Ursula Royteam.
Hey, good morning. Happy Thursday, and thank you for listening to the G and Ursula Show. The First Lady, she released a statement yesterday that revealed Barron Trump also caught the coronavirus. But that's not even the most eye-popping thing that Melania Trump revealed. We'll tell you what that is at 10:30. But now, Ursula, we got a guest.
We do. You know, it seems like we have tried everything to get homeless people off the streets. But if you look around, you can't help but notice it seems like the problem just keeps growing. So we talked about this thing that is happening in British Columbia. And the question is, what if we just handed out cash? Because that is what happened up in BC, a first of its kind direct giving project that gave $7,500 to the homeless. So could something like that get results here? Joining us now is Claire Williams, who is the co-founder and CEO of Foundations for Social Change. That is the organization that passed out those checks. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning, G and Ursula.
Thank you so much for joining us. So first of all, why do this? How much does Vancouver spend each year on each homeless person right now?
Yeah, so I don't have a breakdown for Vancouver, and those costs seem to be quite nebulous depending on who you ask. But we do have a statistic that across Canada, the average cost of someone experiencing homelessness is anywhere from $53,000 to $134,000 per person per year. So that varies depending on the level of services that they're drawing upon, interactions with the criminal justice system, health costs, et cetera. And so we were looking at evidence coming out of developing countries on the power of cash transfers to empower people to move beyond poverty. And we thought, why don't we try that here?
And so what specifically did you try? How many people and who did you choose?
Yeah, so we ran our project as a randomized control trial, and we randomly selected 50 people who are recently homeless to receive a one-time cash transfer of $7,500. So these people had to meet some initial eligibility criteria. So we looked at people's age, we looked at length of time homeless, and we're working specifically with people who are recently homeless. And then we were also looking at a degree of functionality, so screening out people who had any significant issues with substance use, alcohol use, and mental health challenges. And so working with a more functional part of the population.
What was the, if you don't mind me asking, what was the age and what was the amount of time homeless that you guys used for the criteria?
Yeah, so age was 19 to 64 years of age, and length of time was under 2 years homeless. And so that's predicated on the belief that if we help people as quickly as we can to the time that they have become homeless, then we prevent them from becoming entrenched in that experience. It then also allows existing resources, like we have a lot of infrastructure here to serve people who are experiencing homelessness. It allows that infrastructure then to focus on people who need more wraparound supports, where maybe cash isn't the right answer, or maybe it's cash and some mental health support, some social services, substance use support. So the idea is that we could relieve the pressure off the existing shelter of care.
Did you guys, you mentioned under 2 years and being able to help someone faster. Was there any kind of study done on those that are homeless for over 2 years? Like, is there a better possibility of mental health issues or a substance abuse issue?
Yeah, well, I think we see that homelessness, the experience of homelessness takes a massive toll on people in terms of their physical health, their mental health. It can lead to self-medicating because living on the streets is really, really rough. So people do, you know, they turn to cigarettes to calm their nervous system. They use alcohol to keep themselves warm. Then there's substance use to keep them awake so that they're not at risk of violence. And I know there was a London program that worked with men who were chronically homeless. They had a personalized budget, so they weren't actually given the money, but they did have money to spend through a trustee, and they saw similar results. So our goal is to keep expanding our parameters to help more people.
And you may be, we're dealing with a couple of different things. The earthquake drill is going to be coming up, and that is going to be a little bit later in the morning. It'll be about 10:23. So if I ask you a question right now that you started answering, it's because I was a little bit distracted, but I want to make sure that we have this answer. So did you talk about the results that you found from giving out this cash?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're seeing amazing results. We're seeing that within 1 month of the cash transfer, people are moving into stable housing. So therefore, they're spending fewer days homeless. We're seeing that people are increasing their spending on food, on clothing, rent, getting their car back on the road so that they can return to employment. We're seeing greater food security across the group. That people are retaining over $1,000 after 12 months, which is pretty incredible in the Lower Mainland. It's really expensive to live here. And then we saw that people are making wise financial choices. So there was actually a 39% reduction in spending on alcohol, cigarettes, and drugs, which counters all of the stereotypes out there that people living in poverty or people living in homelessness can't be trusted to make wise financial choices. And our data shows that that's just not the case.
So someone listening to this, Claire, would say, okay, so naturally, you wouldn't think you can just throw money at the problem. Were there a lot of stipulations in terms of what to do with that money?
Absolutely none whatsoever. So this is a pure unconditional cash transfer. We really believe in people. That's one of our taglines, is believe in someone. And we believe that people, when given the opportunity, will make the best choices to move their lives forward.
Wow. First of all, I just want to say I love what you just said, number one, and because I do believe in that. I do believe that people have to be empowered. And when you are empowered, you usually are able to make better decisions. But what I wanted to talk about here is here in the United States, as opposed to you guys up there, up north, our neighbors. It feels like sometimes I'm hearing you say this and I'm thinking that it sounds good, but here things are a little bit different where you guys don't have a gun problem, where we have gun problems, or you guys, we have a problem with health care. You guys don't have a problem with health care. Can you speak to the advantages that you think you feel is like socially with things going around there to help you guys be successful with this $7,500 deal?
Yeah, well, we do have a social safety net, but by no means is it foolproof. And I think the pandemic has really revealed the gaps in the social safety net and where we are really failing a lot of marginalized populations. And I think in that respect, Canada is quite similar to the U.S. And you have some great projects going on down there in the States. Like you have the Stockton project, whereby they're giving out $500 a month to 100 families over the course of 18 months, again, to test this concept of, is it just a little bit of money that people need to move themselves forward that will give them that sense of stability so they can start making better decisions in their lives. So, you know, I think we like to shine the light on Canada and say everything's great up here, but we definitely have our challenges. And I think that we're seeing that there is an increased receptivity both in Canada and the States to handing out cash. I know you guys got a $1,200 check when the pandemic first hit. Up here in Canada, our government awarded people $2,000 a month. So I think politicians are slowly starting to see that instead of building all of this infrastructure and needing to convert that cash into goods and services that may not empower people to move forward, it might just be cheaper to give them cash up front and more effective.
Claire, just listening to, I know, I'm just, my mouth is like, wait, what? Okay, so if we're looking at your project, what would you recommend? Because we have a homelessness crisis that seems to be getting worse. And if you're following anything that is going on down here in Seattle in particular, now we don't even have our navigation team, which was a team that was set up to help address people who are chronically homeless and specifically also getting them out of these illegal encampments. So now we don't even have that. What can we learn? What do you think other cities, and so you're talking about Vancouver, you know, similar size cities can learn from that project?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that we need to start being brave and courageous and taking meaningful risk in the name of advancing social change. I also think we need to take a careful look at our stereotypes and our prejudices around people living in poverty. Nobody likes to be stereotyped, and they're very harmful. And I think they prevent us from seeing some really evident solutions, easy, simple, elegant solutions that could help change people's lives and resolve problems if we just dropped our biases and stereotypes. I also think that we just need more compassion and evidence in our policymaking. We need to start seeing the people behind the circumstance and stop blaming them and criminalizing for the situations that they find themselves in.
Woo! That is the voice of. I apologize.
You're echoing many themes that G talks about, and we
daily.
Talk about in a show. But yeah, you're definitely confirming a lot of what
this is the voice of. Claire Williams. She is the co-founder and CEO of Foundations for Social Change, and she joins the G and Ursula Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You know, right now down here during this pandemic, and I'm glad you covered the basis of how this pandemic has exposed and uncovered a lot of gaps and issues that we have as a society in general. Right now you're talking about a simple thing of giving out cash to homeless, so $7,500. And we have an issue with our folks on unemployment getting their unemployment benefits on time. So that's kind of a tough issue as well. I want you to maybe, if you will, speak a little bit to like the chronically homeless and things. And so outside of cash, do you guys also offer counseling and give ways of giving people jobs? Speak about that.
Yeah. So for the pilot project, we did offer half of our participants coaching. So the idea was that people would work one-on-one with a coach, meeting three times a month for a period of 6 months. And what we found out, and this is a beautiful example, is we found out that we, as decision makers, valued coaching more than the people we were trying to help. So at that time in people's lives, they weren't ready for coaching. What they needed was practical support to move their life forward. And I think there's a big takeaway there for all of us who are in positions of power and decision making. We value something and we think others are going to. And we could have just asked those folks and said, hey, you know, before we invest all this time and money into building out a coaching program, is this something you could actually use? And we take ownership for that. We never ask that question. And I think that's another point that we need to bring forward in terms of when we address these problems. It's actually asking the people that we're trying to help for feedback. Would this be helpful for you? And I also think recognizing that there's no one size fits all solution. So this is not going to work for everybody who's experiencing homelessness. But for a subset of the population, it is going to work for them. And it's just like the general population, right? We all have different wants, needs, desires, goals, objectives, and not everything is going to work for us. So we need to be a bit more creative and start experimenting with different approaches.
Claire, you bring up a great point because it's not a one size fits all solution, and you have to try this multi-pronged approach. What do you do? Because one of the biggest problems we have are these illegal encampments that are everywhere, and now they're popping up on our city parks or area parks. And because of the pandemic, nothing is being done. What are you guys trying up there to deal with people who want to stay in these illegal camps and are refusing any kind of help? You said you found out that people don't want counseling necessarily. But what do you do when you have a clash between what they want and then what the public wants as well?
Yeah, and I can't speak to that with any degree of expertise. So I am in, you know, building an expertise in direct cash transfers and running the project that we have done. In terms of homelessness in general, I can't say that I have an expert opinion on that. We do have tent cities growing here in Vancouver. I know that it's causing a lot of contention in communities. There's a lot of conflict, a lot of fear. And I do think there's room for dialogue and understanding. And in terms of people not wanting to move on, it's sticky. And I don't have a creative solution for how to move forward beyond having a conversation. And I know that there are some very skilled people out there that could have those conversations. But it's looking for that win-win situation, and really, providing humanitarian support. So seeing the people behind the circumstance as opposed to demonizing people as like the scary other, I think is one of the things that's been missing from the conversation. And you'll notice even in the language that I use, I always say people who are experiencing homelessness. I try to see the people before the circumstance, and I feel that eases some of the tension around those conversations.
As someone who has experienced homelessness myself, I totally understand and very much so respect how you address that. I really love that. One of the things that I really talk about a lot, like, it is hard for me to talk about the homelessness problem without talking about the root of a lot of our problems, and which has to do with the cost of living and the wage gap. And I guess I want to ask what's going on up there. I do know that the cost of living is very high up there in Vancouver, BC. I want to know, what are some of the things that are being done for either affordable housing or being able to get jobs up there in Vancouver?
I would say not enough, G. Housing affordability, it's a crisis across Canada. We've seen, I think, similar to the States, the financialization of the housing market. So, you know, they're no longer people's homes, they're investments. And people own 3, 4, 8 houses, which then prices a lot of people out of the market. And then in turn, we're seeing that business, especially from a minimum wage perspective, is just not paying enough for people to make ends meet. You know, here in Vancouver, I think the last thing I heard is that a one-bedroom apartment costs $2,200 a month. I don't know how people are affording that. So I know that there are families of four living in a one-bedroom apartment, scraping together the money, working in multiple jobs in order to make ends meet. And then I know with a rising gig economy, too, and people not having any kind of job security, people are really struggling. Like, they're working 3, 4, 5 jobs. And since we went public, we've had a stream of inquiries come in and requests for help. And so the need across our communities, both here in Canada and in the States, is immense. And it's a very real. People are struggling right now, and we have to do more to help them.
Claire Williams, you're out here doing amazing work. Thank you so much for taking the time to join our show.
Thanks for having me here. It was great talking to you guys.
Thank you.
That was Claire Williams. She is the co-founder and CEO of Foundations for Social Change. And Ursula, I got to tell you, there's a lot of people in this world that are like Claire, and we need more of them, because everything that she was saying was, I mean, look, it doesn't matter if you agree or disagree, right? It doesn't matter where that's from. But what I loved what she said was the most important part. And I think earlier today, you said this earlier, mm-hmm. is our people that are in charge need to be more creative.
Mm-hmm.
That was the final message. Like, okay, whatever your opinion is, a lot of people are like, well, don't give these people money. Don't give them. They just do drugs. Like, let me just tell you guys, not all people that are homeless are on drugs. I can personally tell you that. It was amazing, Ursula.
Yeah, absolutely. Love to hear her perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing I wanted to address is kind of maybe it's a weak spot you might look at in this project, and that is it targets the homeless people who are recently homeless and relatively able-bodied, able to help themselves. We tried something like this here in Washington State in Olympia. That was the whole idea of the tent city, is that down there they'd get people into a tent city where it was safe, it was stable. They could lock up their things, and then they could go about finding jobs, etc. I think they only moved something like 40 out of 200 people into housing after a year. So this is something that we looked at trying or helping that population specifically here, mm-hmm. and as of yet, it hasn't been successful.
You know what, you got to. But the thing that I also heard is that you have to keep trying, and you have to keep. And it's not one size fits all, and mm-hmm. And also you can't just throw money without any sort of. Results, expecting some kind of result, right? I mean, you can't keep doing the same thing over and over and over again if it's not working.
That's what I love about the G and Ursula Show. Every single day, trying to be better than we were yesterday. Hey, the First Lady, she released a statement yesterday that revealed that her son, Barron Trump, had also contracted the coronavirus. But that wasn't the most eye-popping thing about what Melania Trump had to say. We'll tell you what that is next. It's G and Ursula.
It is now 10:35. Welcome back to the G and Ursula Show. This hour of our show is brought to you by Economy Fence Center. So ever since President Trump was diagnosed with COVID-19, we've been hearing all the details about his experience with the virus, but we really haven't heard much about how it has affected the First Lady until now. Melania Trump released a rare public statement yesterday in which she revealed that their son, Barron, also caught coronavirus but experienced no symptoms. But it was the rest of that statement that has a lot of people speculating. Was this a cry for help? Was this a warning? And I know that you and Chef G had texted each other while I was taking a very long nap yesterday.
How long was your nap?
It was 4 hours.
That's not a nap.
I know.
That's hibernation.
I know. I'm seriously thinking something is wrong. But anyway, So what were your guys' thoughts first? I mean, you thought there was something really unusual.
Well, it was one of those things where I'm just like, is this a cry for help? And I cannot believe that the Trump administration and or campaign allowed for Melania to send this out. This directly contradicts everything that President Trump has been saying. I mean, look at what she's saying. She's talking about how she had headaches and everything. Like, she was absolutely being real about
COVID. She was. And I actually appreciated her statement. So she says, I experienced body aches, a cough, and headaches, and felt extremely tired most of the time. I chose to go a more natural route in terms of medicine, opting for vitamins and healthy food. And then she mentioned that the president went to Walter Reed strictly as a precaution. She was, you know, profusely thanking the great medical staff that treated her family. And then she says, I encourage everyone to continue to live the healthiest life they can. A balanced diet, fresh air, and vitamins really are vital to keep our bodies healthy. For your complete well-being, compassion and humility are just as important in keeping our minds strong.
So, before Chef weighs in,
I emphasize those two words.
I know Chef's ready to fire. Well, I got one more thing to say, Chef. Before you fire in, Chef, it reminds me, look, we've all known of the couple that has the nice wife but is married to a jerk, right? But then again, you kind of wonder. You're like, we always, like, can you believe she's with that guy? But then again, you're like, well, wait a minute. Maybe she isn't the person that we think that she is. Because Melania comes off one way saying like, oh, you know, she tries to be so caring and hashtag be best and all of those things. But is Melania really that way? Or does she like to play both sides? Those are the dangerous folks that love to play both sides. Now, Chef, I know you're going to weigh in, bro.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I was hesitant to write you guys last night because I felt crazy. But I read that statement. I encourage everyone to continue to live the healthiest life they can. Balanced diet, fresh air, and vitamins really are vital to keep our bodies healthy. And for your complete well-being, compassion and humility are just as important in keeping our minds strong. Wait, compassion and humility? Those are the two words that I would use to describe the exact opposite of Donald Trump. Let's see. Balanced diet, fresh air, and vitamins vital to keeping healthy. Not Donald Trump. It seems like a direct condemnation of his mental and physical health, honestly. I mean, in everything that she comes out and does publicly is somehow at odds with what her husband does. Just look at the Be Best anti-bullying social media campaign. It just struck me as very, very bizarre. Like, whatever she says, I look at her and I'm like, wait, are you blinking a couple times because there's some sort of coded message here? But, gee, you said, no, I read that too.
Read the same thing. I mean, like, so, but which Melania is this, though? Like, you guys do know that right before the president, like, I think it was like a day before the president announced that he had COVID, Melania Trump was recorded saying some not so nice things. So I'm curious, which Melania are we talking about?
Wait, in case anyone doesn't know what we're talking about here.
You say I'm complicit. I'm the same like him. I support him. I don't say enough. I don't do enough.
No.
Where I am, I'm working like a ass, my ass.
I know.
Christmas stuff that, you know, who gives a f*** about Christmas stuff and decoration, but I need to do it, right?
Yeah, but 100%. You have no choice.
And okay, and then I do it, and I say that I'm working on Christmas, planning for the Christmas, and they said, oh, what about the children that they were separated? Give me break. Where they were saying anything when Obama did that?
I know.
I cannot go. I was trying to get the kid reunited with the mom. I didn't have a chance. Needs to go through the process and through the law.
Okay, can I am going to defend her again. And last time I defended Melania, oh my gosh, I just could not stop getting emails from people saying, I can't believe you would defend her. But I think she's in an impossible situation. And you can say, well, she's the first lady and she can do this, she can do that. There are times when it looks to me so obvious that she wants to distance herself, but she's not able to. So even that whole, you know, be best thing, I take it that that's really what she wants. And she's going separate from what her husband is showing.
So when she wore the coat, I really don't care. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I know. I know there was some sort of explanation. Did she ever explain that? I can only imagine she was trying to get some message across, but maybe I'm just, you know, my personality is to give people the benefit of the doubt. You're being very quiet there.
I know.
And so I just look at it and I look at that message and I say, I know for a fact that she cares deeply about her son, Baron. She is very protective and Mama Bear about his privacy, as she should be. So I give credit for that. And I know that there are things in the past and people keep throwing that. And she was a birther originally, blah, blah, blah. I mean, and I don't want to say blah, 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 because that was very serious and disgusting.
You know the old saying, I have a lot more to say about this, but we're running out of time. So I'll just keep it simple.
Yeah.
When people show you who they are, believe them. That's it.
But is there, I know, and I love that, but is there any room for redemption? Is there any room where you can say, you know what I did there, what I said there was wrong, but I am trying to be who I am, even in this environment where it's very difficult?
To be fair, she said that the most important part of her recovery was the opportunity to reflect on family, friendships, my work, and staying true to who you are.
There you go.
I will say this. Again, I don't know how the Trump administration allowed that to get out. Like, that directly contradicts her husband. But everything she says when she's talking directly contradicts her husband. All right. Coming up next, let's get a little scenarios, liven things up. And then this is a time for Chef to be the hero. We'll do that next. It's Gene Ursula. Gene Ursula Show. Coming up in 15 minutes, did NBC make a mistake? Well, and agree to disagree, Ursula and I, we will discuss that. But right now, it is time for a very good scenarios, Ursula.
Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. So what, so what, so what's the scenario?
G. Ursula and Chef, I'm 22 years old and about to graduate from college. I have a great job that will be lined up in life. Looks pretty sweet considering what we're all going through. Plus, I have a great fiance and he's graduating too. He's going to be graduating in the spring. We plan to be married by next summer. We are now planning the event as if the world will be back to normal by then. Hopefully, we can have a regular wedding. Last week, I mentioned that it would be a sweet idea to have both my dad and my biological dad, John, walk me down the aisle. This is where it kind of gets nuts. Okay, here's the deal. My mom and dad nearly divorced because she cheated on my dad with John, and she became pregnant with John's baby. Well, that's why John is my biological dad. You get it? Yes. They cheated. I came about because of that. Now, my parents stayed together and kept the secret from me for 15 years. John was always around, though. He was a family friend, and we even did things together. I finally figured it out when someone mentioned how much John and I look alike. And he got this funny look on his face and said, "There's a reason for that." We worked through it and have stayed fairly close ever since. So I brought it up, and my family went nuts. I was told I was ungrateful, and my mom said John wasn't half the man your dad is and wasn't there for me as a kid. My dad agreed and told me I had to choose one or the other. Then he said he would be disappointed and it would be disrespectful to John. I am devastated. Now my parents are threatened to come to the wedding and not come to the wedding or help pay for the wedding if John is included in any way. My fiance thinks I should go with my heart, even if it means a wedding without my parents. I desperately want my family there, but this is so hard. 98973 is the State Roofing text line. What should she do? Ursula?
Wow. That is really complicated. And, oh, there's so much emotion that goes into a wedding. And there are things that happen at weddings that end up affecting everything and everybody. So I would continue to try to work out something that would be acceptable to include. I mean, because she really wants that. This is her wedding. But I also think that it could be so hurtful. I think they need to compromise. The biological dad needs to have some other role, but not take the place of mom walking her. I mean, I would rather have dad and mom walk her down the aisle. or just the dad who raised her, and then biological dad, he actually should maybe offer to say, hey, you know what? I would really love to be, how about I be one of the groomsmen? Or I can help with the guest book or something.
Agree. You know what, guys? I know this sounds complicated, and Chef, I'm going to go first, and then I know you're going to steal the show. But this is one of those, this is easy for me. This is where the biological dad has to, look, man, take the back seat to this one.
Yes.
Go ahead and say, no, you know what? I don't want to walk you down the aisle. Let me be a groomsman.
Yep.
Or let me do something else. But yes. It's just too messy, and you would make the wedding messier.
And there Chef. Are things that will never be undone.
Nah, you can't do that. Chef?
This is so rough. I think I agree with you. Honestly, the biological dad needs to take himself out of the game, because I cannot imagine you have gotten over what is probably the biggest hurt you will ever experience in your life, the biggest betrayal you've ever experienced, and you still do the right thing and move forward and you build a family together, and then the guy that perpetrated that is walking your daughter down the aisle with you.
No.
But how did they stay friends in the first place? Like, this whole family sounds like a beautiful nightmare, I guess. Like, I can't believe they got over this, and they're dealing with this now.
Well, they probably did. A lot of people make decisions to keep the peace, and so that the daughter doesn't get raised by, you know, by such a family that's full of vitriol. It's peaceful, even though people have to put away some of their hurt.
Or compromise. Like, both of them are at the doorway of the church, right? And they're both holding her arm. They walk in together, all three of them, and then the dad takes her down the aisle. The biological dad sits in the back pew.
Oh, I like that one, too. Yeah, there's some way, but I think the biological dad could make the biggest difference in saying, you know what, absolutely not. The dad who raised you should get first dibs.
I tell y'all what, when life hands you lemons, whoa, this ain't a situation where they made lemonade. Boy, this is some serious stuff, right?
Oh, yeah.
Look, if we all have some type of family drama, right?
And
you know, we all got it. And so the best thing to do, I know Ursula always gives us the communicate and compromise. Yes, that's that. But sometimes you got to work smarter and not harder. And in this case, biological dad, man, go ahead, sit this one out, player. Let's put the show on. You take the back seat, and then everybody kind of knows there's some whispering going on, but we don't want the whispering to be something, because the one thing that's dangerous today about cell phones is people like me will video that and have a great story to tell. And Ursula, you know I love to tell a story based on video, don't I?
Oh, yeah.
So you don't want nobody taking video of that. And then, so let me get this straight. Biological and daddy took him down the aisle. I got the video to show it. It gets nasty. Coming up next, we agree to disagree. It's Gene Ursula.